Hi all. Welcome back to Rewatchable and thanks for joining us as we rewatch Avatar: The Legend of Korra. We are currently up to book 2, episodes 7 and 8, which is Beginnings part 1 and part 2. Which is a pretty special and unique double episode of Legend of Korra showing the formation of the Avatar and the Avatar cycle. So, if you want to get in touch with us to talk about this episode or future episodes, past episodes, you can reach us on rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at re_watchable. You can comment on this post on hyperbole.com, who hosts our podcasts. Or you can join us on Tumblr, which is rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. I'm your host this week, Natalie. And we are being joined this week by another super fan, Caitlin, and by newbies, Karen and Brittany. In our new tradition of specifying our voices, I'll give you a sentence from me, which is, I'm Natalie. I just woke up and I had a very disturbing dream before I woke up about running away and going off the grid, about like running away from everyone that knows me and going off in secret like a super spy. And that was very disturbing because I have no idea why I felt the need to do that. But I definitely had a cache of shoes buried in a garden somewhere that I had to pick up. So that was weird. We'll go. What order has he put these in? Okay, so we'll just go in the order that they're there, I suppose. Karen, would you like to let listeners get to know your voice a bit?
Yes, my fun fact is that I hate bananas, except I love banana bread.
Wow, that's deep. I just ate a banana about 5 minutes before we started, so
Blech.
sorry about that. Okay, Brittany.
Hi, I'm Brittany, obviously, and I hate fun facts. Can that be my fun fact? Because I can never think of anything that sounds interesting.
Usually I literally just look around and or I'm like, what has happened to me in the last 5 minutes?
Oh,
Slash,
I just got summoned
what
for
is
jury
Namie?
duty. I just
Oh,
got
wow,
summoned for
that's
jury
kind of
duty.
cool.
So,
Wow.
no, it's
Are you gonna
not.
go?
I have to. I don't have a
I don't know.
choice.
I was summoned once, but I got out of it because I was ill. So I don't know if there's like some excuse that you can have. But good luck if you do get to do it. I hope that it's not like a creepy, weird trial and
I
that you're
almost
not
got
on
put
there.
on a trial last time I did jury duty 3 years ago, and I hope I don't get put on one this time.
Caitlin.
Hi, my fun fact. I just looked around my room, and I guess my fun fact will be that I own more shoes than fit in my closet.
Oh, yeah, that's a problem, I suppose, but you know, a nice one to have.
Maybe you should
Nice.
bury them in the backyard or
Yeah.
something.
All right, we're all good. Hopefully, you are able to distinguish who is who when we're speaking on this episode now. So, we've got a double synopsis for this one because it is a flowing episode that goes in from one to the other. In these chapters, Ariana finally gets the flashbacks she wasn't asking for. Korra heals from the spirit's attack, while fire sages tell her to find Rava, essentially the Avatar spirit. Enter Wan, he's basically Aladdin and just wants to feed all of the little birdies in town. He gets the power to bend fire from a lion turtle and is banished to the scary spirit wilds after using his power for evil. Wan hangs out with Zubumafu at a spa for a bit, ruins everything by separating good and evil, and gains the power of all four elements to defeat Vatu before harmonic convergence. With Vatu locked away, Wan's eventual death triggers the first Avatar spirit reincarnation. Korra remembers who she is, grabs a convenient air bison, and is off to see the wizard. So, just to translate that into real person language, this episode focused on the formation of the Avatar cycle going back 10,000 years because we're about to have another harmonic convergence, and the first one was 10,000 years ago. And we see how the Avatar came to be, how humans used to live And how they got the power of bending, basically, and how one person ended up being able to have all four powers and what it meant to actually be the Avatar. And it came from a human getting sort of combined with the spirit for good and balance in the world. So the first discussion point we have here was, who were the Fire Sages? And Mitch has asked if anyone else thought that the Fire Sage was Azula. I have no idea if this is a popular fan theory or not, because this is not something that ever crossed my mind. But Caitlin, have you ever heard anything about this?
I have not, and it never crossed my mind either.
Okay, just checking that it wasn't just me, you know, just wondering. So no, I didn't think she was Azula. Anyone else think she was Azula?
No.
No.
No. No. Okay, we'll move on from that. And we've also asked, can you heal with fire, a la waterbending? And again, not sure why that is there, because they sort of just do dunk her in some water anyway. I think the water was doing the healing job rather than just the fire. But I'm pretty sure that you can't heal with fire. It seems counterproductive to
have fire. Actually, I was sort of on that like vein of thought for a hot minute. But actually, like, fire is sort of healing and about rebirth and everything. So not that I really think that you could heal with fire, but I don't think it's totally out of the question. My, like, thought was, when I saw the scene, was how she held the fire over Korra's body and could, like, tell something was weird with her. That I don't think we've ever seen before.
Yeah, I think that we are, you know, as I've said many times, that, you know, it's been 10,000 years since people have gotten bending. Now we know that exact number. That you'd think that they've found ways to use it in more than just basic, I throw fire, you know, I throw water, I throw air, I throw rock. You know, I think that, especially if you're a very kind of working in a spiritual person, you're a monk or a sage, you know, or something like that, that you would be able to develop the power that you have for the needs that you have. You know, you can make any element kind of try and fit the need that you end up having. So it is possible, but I don't know. The Fire Sages, I assume, is still the same island of Fire Sages that we saw in Avatar The Last Airbender. And so they've been hanging out there being non-evil firebenders, you know, since before the Hundred Years War. So that's nice. Lucky that Korra washed up there and not, like, somewhere else totally terrible, basically.
Yeah, I'm so confused about this. Why are there all of these people all over the world who know so much about the Avatar, and none of them are like, I'll just wait till she shows up here?
Yeah, they're not like, oh, we've got to all gather, like, in this place. You know, there's, like, a new Avatar, and she should be...
Like, these people didn't help Aang, and they were clearly around when Aang was there, because they were there for the 100 years, whatever. Like, they were alive, but no one wants to help them. I don't get it. It's like, they should create an Avatar University where everyone who knows even one little fact about what it means to be an Avatar comes in and is just like, hey, I know this. And then they, like, make a book, and they can just give it to the Avatar when they come of age. That was the most frustrating thing about these people.
Yeah, or they could have not locked Korra in a little icy castle where she got to think that she was a queen and could tell everyone what to do and not have to use money and stuff like that. Could send her on travels around the world to meet all of these people and have these, like, beautiful sagely lessons, you know, and maybe then she'd learn how to act in proper society and not think it's okay to just, like, kick over a desk in public because she's mad at her boyfriend. So, yeah.
I don't know. To play devil's advocate there, though, I kind of feel like the Avatar sort of has to learn these lessons as they come up. Like, can you imagine Korra, who was locked away, kind of getting sent to this Avatar University and all these people telling her what to do? Like, clearly that wasn't working when Tenzin was telling her that. And she was really, like, she was fighting against him the way that he was teaching her. I feel like she has to hit rock bottom and she has to wash up on shore with no memory of who she is in order to learn these lessons the way that she has. So maybe this is sort of just like the universe kind of giving her those lessons as she needs them. rather than feeding her all this information that she might not use right away.
Yeah, but yeah. I want this to have happened when she was 5, not she's already an angsty, angry teenager.
Yeah, it's like shape I was thinking her personality. Like, yeah, don't give her the chance to become this. And don't, like, push it. Be like, 4 times a year she goes on holiday. She goes on a great vacation around the world, you know, and gets to meet all of these cool people, and it's really exciting and good and, like, stuff like that. Yeah, don't give her the chance to become this person with this attitude.
The way Aang took Tenzin away. Like, he took him on all these trips, and Tenzin was like, I had so much fun with Dad, but didn't realize that he was, like, being, like, trained, you know? Like, kind of, like, slip it in, like, a fun, like, let's go to Ember Island for the weekend and have these just, oh, look at these fire sages who showed up at Ember Island. They're going to teach you some history with a fun play about the first Avatar.
Well, we also don't know what Avatar training was like before the Hundred Years War, because when Aang found out he was the Avatar, it was very clear they had a process he was supposed to go through, like find out when he was 16 and then go through this process. So maybe there was something like that and the war completely destroyed it. And because Aang was the Avatar who kind of bridged the gap, you know, he didn't know that. So that just fell away. We don't really have any way of knowing.
That's true. They definitely came and told Roku he was the Avatar on his 16th birthday, because we saw that in the flashback with him and Sozin. But he was okay with it. He didn't act like a dick about it. Like, sorry, but he didn't. And he became a capable enough Avatar, I suppose. Not capable enough to kill his BFF. But that is such a Dumbledore and Grindelwald situation. But you know, he became capable enough. And Aang, you know, I suppose didn't end up having that. So going into the actual flashback that Korra starts having about finding Rava and who the hell is Rava, it was a double. Like, we basically go, you know, Korra, flashback, and a little bit of Korra, and then into the next episode, flashback again. Did you guys find that you liked this, or was it too much flashback? Would have you rather this was packed down into one episode and get on with the plot? Or did you, after all of this time, actually like having the exploration of this subject stretched over 2 episodes? Brittany, how did you feel about it as a newbie getting the Avatar story like this?
I liked it because it was a break from Korra, and I think I needed that at this point. I really needed a break from Korra at this point. So I thought it was good. I'm glad that they did it over 2 episodes, because then you're kind of left with a bunch of questions after the first, if it were to kind of be like jam packed in there. Like, we wouldn't have been able to learn about like lion turtles and like where people exist and how all the different bendings exist and like where everyone is. So I was fine with it. And I liked that there was different animation and stuff. So it kept it interesting enough to where 2 episodes didn't feel like it was taking a huge chunk of anything.
Yeah. Karen, how about you seeing this for the first time? Is this kind of anything even close to the story you expected for how bending and the Avatar came about?
Honestly, I haven't really given it a lot of thought as to the origins. I wasn't sure how it first began. I think that the story was amazing. I really liked seeing the beginnings. I'm actually disappointed that it was only 2 episodes. Like, I kind of want to see a whole show, like several seasons, about Wan and everything that he had been through and the way that he developed his powers for the first time and everything, because I really loved his character. Maybe not right at the very beginning, but definitely grew to love him, and I thought it was so interesting. So, yeah, I kind of wanted more, actually.
Caitlin, how about you?
I love these 2 episodes. I like that, like Brittany brings up, it has the different art style to it that looks very like Japanese painting, which is it's gorgeous. I love the animation in these 2 episodes, and it does a really good job of differentiating it from the rest of the show. And it's just such an interesting story that, like Karen, I actually hadn't given a lot of thought to, but then you start going into it and you're like, oh, of course that's a question that we should have. So I really like it. I don't think I would have liked seasons about it, but I thought it was just the right amount.
Yeah, I really love it as well, and I find it interesting that in Atla they never, you know, ask the question who was the first Avatar. I suppose it's like, it's interesting that they sort of saved that till now, or thought about it now. And I was just going to say, Brittany, as well as the animation being very beautiful and different, it's a return to that very sort of peaceful, melodic music, not the crazy music that I know you're not a massive fan of in Legend of Korra. So that might have been a nice brain rest. But going into Wan and his universe, because there's a lot of stuff to talk about the origin story. First of all, did you guys end up liking Wan, like, as the first Avatar? He kind of starts out as, you know, like we mentioned earlier, he's a bit of an Aladdin. Like, he lives on a lion turtle, like a lion turtle city, and he is one of the poor people, and there is sort of a ruling family who have weapons and power, and this guy basically tries to steal food from them. So, I mean, we don't know too much about how those other guys got the power or why some people are poor and some people are rich in this particular society. But how did you kind of feel about his origins as a street rat, etc.? Caitlin, do you actually like the character?
I do, and I'm so glad that Aladdin was brought up, because I was singing One Jump Ahead to myself during that whole chase scene in the beginning. Yeah. So I was like, riff raff, street rat. So
yeah,
I'm glad that came up, because it's totally true. But I like his development a lot, how he changes and it feels very organic, and I think he's a very interesting character.
Yeah. Karen, how about you? I mean, what he was doing is basically like straight up stealing, like, and then he, you know, there's do you think that this is sort of an Aladdin situation of people being forced to steal because they're too poor, or do you think that he was kind of like, it's not like every other person out there was trying to steal? Do you think he was justified in his need to feed his little tree man friend and his birds that probably could have gone and got food from nature?
Aw. yeah, I think he was justified in it, because, I mean, they said that the Chews, I think their name was, they were hoarding all of that food, and clearly they were being well fed. I mean, they were fairly rotund, so they didn't have, you know, anything to worry about. And they were, overbearing. And so I feel like if he wasn't getting enough food, and he was sharing it, so it wasn't like he was being a jerk and just hoarding it all for himself. Like, he was doing his part to help who and what he could. So, yeah, I thought it was great, actually. I think that kind of endeared you to the character from the very beginning.
Yeah. And then the other thing that he does is, you know, that whole attitude of stealing from the lion turtle, I guess, like going out into the wilds to do hunting, or pretending to, at least, in order to get the power of fire, and then keeping the power of fire and using it against, you know, the Chews and basically burning down his city. So, yeah, Brittany, did you think that that was kind of a douche move, in terms of, like, it's one thing to steal from the Chews, but it's another thing to steal from the lion turtle?
Yeah, well, you knew that was going to backfire the second that it happened. But yeah. I don't think that his, like, he wasn't necessarily using it for evil so much as he was like, well, I have this power, I can, like, finally feed everyone who deserves to be fed, type of deal, at least in the beginning. But then I think he got a little power crazy.
Yeah. The whole concept, so that, let's talk about that, the whole concept of the rules of Wan's, not his universe, because it's the same universe as Korra, but what society was like then, was that humans lived on the back of lion turtles. When they went out into the real land, when they came off the lion turtle island and came to the real land, the lion turtle gifted them with the power of an element in order to fight off the spirits. And apparently not returning it once you get back to the city was, you know, enough to get banished from the city. And everyone on a lion turtle thinks that they're the only lion turtle city, a la pre-Columbus planet Earth, before people started, like, crossing the world and discovering other continents. So Yeah, this is a really interesting, I guess, history that, you know, that no one lived on the actual Earth's surface, like that this universe's continents, and they only lived on the lion turtles because the lion turtles felt like that they had to protect the humans from the spirits. So that's quite unusual. And obviously we've seen the lion turtle give Aang the power to do bending, special, you know, spirit bending or whatever it was that he did to take away, you know, to take away Ozai's bending. But we've also had quite a bit of discovery throughout the show of like, oh, you know, the Badger Moles were the first earthbenders and the dragons, you know, humans learnt firebending from the dragons and, you know, the moon was the first waterbender. So it was actually a bit of a confusion or a contradiction to see the lion turtles actually give the art of bending. And I think it's a good example of sort of myths getting muddled, if you know what I mean. Like possibly not everyone knows the story of the first Avatar, but they might have known what came since then, because you see that, you know, Wan does end up learning actually how to use his firebending from the dragon and stuff like that. So I guess what I'm asking is yeah, did any of those original myths that we learnt in Atla come into your head, and were you confused about the bending process with lion turtles versus what we've learnt before about, you know, how humans got bending? Karen, did you remember any of those?
I didn't until you just brought it up, but obviously that's a really good point. And I'm just trying to think, like, I mean, if the Badgers were the first earthbenders, that doesn't necessarily negate the fact that the lion turtles gave earthbending to humans for the first time. So I think both of those myths could still technically exist in the same universe.
Mm. Caitlin, how about you as a super fan? Did those myths stick out with you? You know, when Aang said, you know, about the air bending with the bisons and the moon first water bending and stuff like that. How do you think that these two feed into each other?
It hit me the most when you see Wan mastering his fire bending, and it was very the dragon in the background is very much an echo of when Zuko and Aang were learning at the temple in season 3 of Atla. So that it popped into my head then. So I kind of agree with Karen. It feels like, you know, those could be the first benders, but that doesn't make, I guess they just aren't necessarily mutually exclusive.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, if Wan's original story and the lion turtles are actually that well known in today's society in the Atla, you know, in the Atla world, because it's not something anyone ever seems to know about or talk about now. So, and the lion turtles were kind of a myth as well, so it's interesting. And so they all live on the lion turtles because basically the spirits inhabit the earth, apparently, that they just sort of randomly bled out from the spirit world because those two portals are open. We meet a bunch of spirits, and apparently they can alter your appearance and kill you if a spirit fights you and takes over your body, which is how we get an explanation for the weird tree man after we see the lemur spirit inhabit someone else and warp his face. So that's quite terrifying. I suppose tree man and he must have been inhabited at one point by a tree spirit. So I suppose the humans would have a healthy fear of the spirits sort of taking over the world. Do we think the spirits kind of had a right to be there, or do you think it's better for them to be in a separate place to humans? Like, Brittany, with what we've seen with spirits so far throughout the two series, do you think that there would have been a way for the spirits to live in harmony without being trapped in their own spirit world?
No, I don't think so, only because people are going to be afraid of what they don't understand regardless, which is why I think that the lion turtles keeping, like, firebenders, earthbenders, waterbenders, everyone separate made a lot of sense, and why there's been nothing but conflict since they all converged.
Yeah.
But I think the same thing goes with spirits, too. They're just, like, because they were, like, creepy to me. Like, if I ran into them, like, there's all these myths built up about them because they're mm-hmm. unlike what everyone else is. So yeah. if I were to, like, walk into the wilds, like, I wouldn't know what to do. I'd be terrified of them, even though they're all just like, I'm not bothering you. I'm just on my way to the oasis. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I would still be scared of them, especially the ones that yeah. look like the characters from Alice in Wonderland, like the little owls with the beaks. They were just missing their glasses. They were so Aww. Cute.
Yeah, so let's talk about, I suppose, the spirits themselves, especially when they get to the oasis where Juan would like to hang out and relax for a little while. He meets his BFF, the II spirit, who doesn't actually have a name, who is a very sassy weirdo, and I love him. But yeah, who was everyone's personal favorites of the spirits that we got to see? You know, Juan ends up being accepted by a spirit community and gets to live with them for a few years and learn about the spirit world and help master his firebending with a beautiful dragon, which I really enjoyed. But favorite of the spirit world creatures that we get to meet that Juan befriends. Karen, who did you like?
Zaboomafu. Definitely.
That's not his name.
It is
but
now.
That's exactly what he looks like.
Yeah. And I loved that show as a kid. So definitely right, him. Fine. But shout out to whoever put this in the doc. All the ones with the baby voices. I thought the voices, yeah. like, they were kind of creepy to begin with. And then they started talking with these cute little children voices. And I was like, oh, I actually kind of love them now.
The big cuddly ones, and they're like, you should go find some more humans. Yeah. They were cute. I loved them. Caitlin, which did you like?
I mean, I like the II spirit, too. Like, he's so sarcastic, and he's all pleased with himself when he says something sarcastic. He just yeah. cracks up laughing, and he's like, ha, 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 ha. Like, yeah. I think characters like that hilarious.
I enjoy him a lot as well. I did like the carrot and the turnip that give Juan the tea. But Brittany, how about you with the spirits?
Like I said before, the ones that look like the little like bird like things from Alice in Wonderland. I liked those guys, and I also liked that this was like kind of the origin of why the Avatar like seems to have an animal companion. Like, yeah, I feel like I ever since the beginning, like, they have an animal with them at all times.
Yeah. I loved the cat deer. She's not a spirit, she's just an
yeah,
animal.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love her, so yeah, that's true. So yeah, Juan is a soft heart who needs to save the animals, and you know, he was feeding his little birds, even though the little birds could fly around and get food elsewhere, probably. And yeah, he basically gets that cat deer and gets to ride her around the world to see, to try and find other lion turtles and learn more about the world. So that's really exciting. I think I like her better than Naga or any, you know, of the other animal companions that we've seen so far. I really enjoy her. But yeah, they do definitely have like a bond with an animal, which I really love. And that probably comes from Juan being such a big softy at the start. But as he's riding around the world, he finds this big battle between two massive spirits that look like kites or manta rays or something. And that's Rava, the spirit for peace and balance, and Vatu, the spirit for chaos. And one of them is this big, beautiful, white and blue, serene-looking thing, and one is like black and red and angry. And Juan still manages to think that, you know, the bad guy is the good guy and ends up separating them by accident. Well, not by accident, on purpose, but then realizes it was a mistake. So would have you guys made this mistake? Do you think it was a valid mistake to make, or do you think that it was very dumb of him, basically? Caitlin, how about you?
I mean, considering it hasn't been that long that he didn't even know there were other human beings in the world, like, it's not really surprising that he has no concept of white being the good association and black being the bad association. Like, his naivete is not surprising in the least. Like, we have way more experience and would be like, oh, duh, the black one is evil, but he has no reason to know that.
I suppose that's true. Yeah, and I was kind of watching it thinking about it was in the reverse, like if we had different associations with colours for stuff like that. But, you know, we do have obviously, yeah, Vatu obviously tries to convince him that he's being bullied and tortured and hurt. And so I suppose it's quite, you know, quite fair for him to have believed that given no prior concept of the situation. But yeah, Karen, how about you? Did you think this was a reasonable move or not?
Oh, definitely. Just because, well, like Caitlin said, I mean, he doesn't really know a whole lot. And the white one was sort of like beating up on the black one. So
yeah.
At first glance, even I was like, oh, what's going on here? Like, you know, I wasn't sure if it was supposed to be good and evil or if it was just two different ones that happened to be like, you know, white and black. And then for him to separate them, I just thought it made a lot of sense. You know, I think it was a very honest mistake and I think he just wanted to help. And unfortunately, because he was so naive, it was a huge mistake to make. But my favorite part was when he was like, no, I'm going to rectify this. It's, you know, I made the mistake. I'm going to fix it. And he didn't stop no matter how hard it got.
Yeah. Brittany, what's your impression of, I guess, Rava's personality once they, you know, once she's sort of saddled with Juan and they have to go around the world looking for Vatu? How did you feel about their kind of relationship, I guess?
Well, I didn't like Rava at first, but then as time went on and they're like, they got to kind of like, you knew what Rava was about and how Rava wanted to make sure that this human like wasn't going to get hurt. It wasn't his battle to fight, even though I guess I could say, is it a she or an it? I don't know.
It's a she.
Okay.
They call her a she. Yeah.
So when she was like telling him, like, I can't like help you too much, like I can't like be take over your body for too long, and like she gets reduced to that like little withered thing that he puts in a teapot, like, aww. She was like really trying to do her best to like make him understand what was going on and teach him along the way, which I liked a lot. I thought that their companionship was great, and it was a great introduction to the like way that human like avatars bond with the spirit world, because I wouldn't have guessed, like, I mean, I forgot to even ask this question while watching it. Like, well, what is it about the spirit world that the avatars get to talk to them about? So I thought this was good. And I liked it. I liked the whole concept of having a Rava and a Vatu and, like, how they're, like, they were locked together in battle and that happened and then they got separated. I loved the whole thing.
I actually found much more sympathy for Rava when she turned tiny and he could like hold her in his arms and he put her in the teapot to protect her. And I was like, you know, it's really sad that as Vatu got bigger, she got smaller. And I think that's when I finally was like, okay, you know, she's sort of, I don't want to say mean because she didn't like him because of the huge mistake that he made, but the weaker she got, the more she relied on him. And I think the more she understood his importance in helping her. And that's when I really started to sympathize with her and understand that really all she wants is to keep that balance.
They seem very codependent. If she wasn't a flat kite thing, I would have called it romantic, just saying. But I don't know. I do like their whole thing, and then the teapot bit is super sad as well. Yeah, but you know, she kind of accompanies him, and as he goes around the world, he meets the first airbenders on their turtle, and which I loved. I loved seeing their little first society, and I would have really liked to see the other first societies as well. But he meets the airbenders, he gets to keep airbending. Anyone have any thoughts about those first airbenders? I love how they sort of just invite him in and they're like, wow, that sounds amazing. Tell us all about your travels, a typical airbender. And then the spirits, they're already friends with the spirits. The spirits have come onto their island, their lion turtle, and are very peaceful with them. And then Vatu comes and makes them all evil and dark. And that was upsetting to me. But
I have some questions about those guys, actually. the Airbenders. First of all, why did their tattoos look different?
Because yeah, society progresses.
So they got lazy and they were just like, okay, arrows now. Because they were like a little more detailed, I feel like.
Well, society sort of changes, I guess. Like, you know, it's been 10,000 years and, you know, the symbols, I guess, have progressed, you know, since then or regressed, you know, one or the other option. I don't know. I'm not an anthropologist. I don't know how this stuff works, but I feel like it's like, I feel like it makes sense to me that it's not just like, oh, they're exactly how they were. They didn't even look necessarily the same. They had a very specific bone structure. I think it's just like the development of like race and culture and stuff like that. And I thought that they looked really good as like an origin. And then 10,000 years later, they have this like new culture, like based on this ancient culture. But no one was actually there 10,000 years ago to tell them that the arrows didn't look quite like that. Like stuff gets changed along the way. And I thought that that was actually a really accurate interpretation of that. So yeah, I don't know. I liked it. Caitlin, how about you with the Airbenders? Did you have any major questions there?
No, that totally is what I assume too. It's just this is the earlier version that develops, and it felt very natural that this would be the earlier version of the Air Nomads and who we know that they are in the present day.
Yeah, I really liked it, but and it made sense to me that they were, you know, able to be friendly with the spirits, whereas the other, you know, the Fire Nation Island was like, no. But they go around collecting all of the bending elements. If you'll notice, it was in the order that the Avatar cycle goes, obviously. Like, he gets fire first, and then air, and then water, and then earth, which is the Avatar cycle, because that's how it goes. So that's the reason that it's in that order that the babies get born into the different elements. And then he masters all of those different types of bending with Rava having to go into him to give him the bending powers. And then he ends up fighting Vatu instead of Rava having to, which apparently is so Dragon Ball Z. So I'll hand over to Caitlin to explain what that means. I do know this guy has like hair very similar to what he did back in before his hair grew out. He did have very Dragon Ball Z hair, but that's all I got there. So Caitlin, do you want to elaborate on that?
I think it's just that this is a very epic scale battle with lots of explosions and destruction and all that, which is what you see in every battle in Dragon Ball Z.
Plus, when Rava coexists with him, it's almost like he's going Super Saiyan. Like, he changes color, sort of. I mean, his hair doesn't change or anything, but it's very much like going Super Saiyan.
I don't know what that is, so okay.
It's like leveling up. It's leveling up.
All right. So this is all taking place while harmonic convergence is happening, which apparently we see is the planets coming into a special line, and their planetary system looks pretty similar to ours. They have a couple of different planets that have rings and stuff like that, but their planets line up in a certain way, and that is going to be the big moment that decides it.
Which
Vatu, oh sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you're probably going to laugh at me for this, Natalie.
No, it's like Hercules.
Ah, yes. Okay. I was like, somebody is going to jump in on this. But actually, I thought the animation was a lot like Hercules, too, because the clouds were very, curly. And the way that, like, the fire shot out and everything and the water, it was just like, and it's flatter than Korra usually is. And it reminded me so much of Hercules. And then the planets aligned and I was like, oh, my God. So that was very exciting to me.
Yeah, so I thought about that too, and I was like, oh, Karen's on this week. Yes.
It definitely has a 2D animation style, like a sort of with that kind of old-fashioned animation that I really like. I cannot say I immediately made the Hercules leap, but I'm really happy for you, Karen. So, yeah, thanks. There you go. So they fight, and basically they end up fighting he ends up asking Rava to come into his body to give him more power, you know, because they can only do it together. And she stays, she's like, no, I can't stay in this long, it'll kill you. And he's like, no, it's working. And that's basically the formation of the Avatar state, of him going into, you know, that superpowered, not quite human, glowing eyes situation. And she ends up staying in his body so long that she's now locked inside him. And so that's kind of weird, in that we see in a little while that they, like, literally talk their whole life. Like, so it is two different beings in his body. They talk to each other inside, you know, inside one's head, yeah. Out loud.
This made me think of how, like, you know, all the other avatars channel the avatars. Like, this is the origin of them being able to, like, talk to the spirit. Yeah. So, like, he's able to talk to Rava, and then, like, you know, later on, like, Aang could talk to, like, Roku, and, like, Korra can go back and talk to Aang. So it's kind of like it just progresses, like, throughout time. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, yeah. But, again, we haven't really heard any of those other avatars talk about Rava and talk about the avatar spirit as being something different. So I'm wondering how much of that story, and given that Korra didn't know about it, I'm wondering how much of the story got lost, if you know what I mean, and how much Rava as a being of her own still exists. You know, as something separate to the person who's sort of housing her, I guess. But they lock Vatu in, like, a magic tree for apparently 10,000 years, and it's about to be harmonic convergence again. And, you know, oh no. And one closes the spirit portholes. He gives everyone, all the spirits, a chance to enter back into the spirit world. And they all sort of sadly, tramp into the spirit world because they're meant to be separate to humans. And he locks them in the spirit world, and then he spends his whole life trying to fight for peace, and he dies in the middle of a war, which is really sad. He seems really disappointed in himself.
Going back just a little bit, I actually kind of have a problem with Vatu being locked away. Maybe this is just me being weird and, like, overthinking it, but I feel like the world needs to be balanced, and I was honestly expecting the Avatar, Wan, to take in Vatu as well, and, like, have both, like, beings balance him out. And the fact that Vatu is being locked away for 10,000 years means that, I mean, of course we want the peaceful spirit to win, but the fact that he was, like, gone out of the world, Vatu was gone out of the world for 10,000 years, makes me feel like the world wasn't balanced? Is that weird?
I'm not sure, because when we meet Vatu and Rava, they're battling. It's like neither of them are achieving anything, basically. All they are doing is stopping each other from taking control.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like the world is being overrun by the good spirit or by the bad spirit, if you know what I mean. They're both just keeping each other from affecting the world more than just banging up a couple of valleys, if you know what I mean.
Exactly.
So now Rava has little to no power. I mean, she has the Avatar. She's in the Avatar, but she's not, like, able to make this big, you know, that's just one person who, no matter how hard they try, they can't actually bring peace and balance to the whole world. And then I don't know if they're still feeling the after effects of Rava's, you know, gigantitude, or if Rava being in the tree is, like, he can still spread, like, a little bit of chaos, or if, like, the humans make their own chaos. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what that means for him to be trapped, if it's right or wrong, but I feel like him being trapped doesn't mean that Rava is winning, if you know what I mean, because she pretty much died and is stuck inside the Avatar, who is nowhere near as powerful as she was. I don't know. Caitlin, how about you? What did you think of that kind of ending up of the separation of chaos and peace spirits?
It makes me wonder if in this world the creation of human beings somehow were tied to Vatu in a way, because we see that humans on their own just continue this discord and destruction even when Vatu is locked away. So it seems like maybe human beings in some sense come from Vatu in a way, while maybe the spirits themselves come from Rava. Like, that was sort of what occurred to me.
Yeah, because we definitely see, you know, Aang, Juan's friends, you know, they get the power of firebending. They decide to go off and live in the wilds and, you know, make their own lives because they've seen that Juan can do it. But they just make gross war with the spirits and destruction and all of that kind of stuff. So it's, I don't know, it is quite confusing. But we wouldn't want Vatu to go free, probably, if there isn't a spirit powerful enough to keep him balanced, if you know what I mean, which I think we're meant to imagine that the Avatar maybe isn't quite, you know, at least not without trapping him in a tree, because the Avatar doesn't spend their whole life, you know, they spend their whole life trying to bring peace, but not literally locked in a physical battle with another spirit to keep it under control. So, I don't know. And then, you know, Juan sadly dies in the middle of a war, feeling disappointed in himself. So who felt sorry for him?
That scene is sad.
Yeah, it is.
He's so old, and he's got, like, purple hair.
We just actually see him die on screen. Like, we watch Rava leave him after he dies. So he dies on screen.
My God. Finally, Avatar. Finally, you show us the death. But it is. So he dies, and then she's like, no, we'll keep trying for all of your lifetimes. We'll be together. We are made for each other. Like, I hope that he didn't have a wife or anything, because that would have been, like, really three people in one marriage. Like the way that they literally talk to each other, not just like, oh, I get in touch with my spirits, like, that he has her there all the time in a conversation and that they're going to be together forever. Like, I don't think there would have been room for him to have a romantic relationship with someone else, just saying. I feel like that would have been weird.
I actually thought it was kind of strange that when she left his body, she sort of, like, dissipated. I was expecting her to, like, go zoom off and into the next person.
Be the kite thing. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. But, yeah, we basically hear the cries of a baby being born, so she's going to go be in a baby now and become the next Avatar. And that person will become the next Avatar, and that's the Avatar cycle that started for, you know, from how many ever years that it's been, 10,000 years. And we get the, you know, impression from what Korra has learned that it's about to be harmonic convergence again, and which could be a problem. And so she kind of wakes up and she's like, oh, I remember everything. I know everything, which is convenient. And then she goes to ride her own air bison, which is also convenient and fun. But I don't know. Yeah. What do you think? I guess, what do you think the point of this all was? Why do you think that she needed to learn this? What do you think she's going to be able to use from this with Unalaq and whatever's going on? Or what do you predict might be the problem, I suppose? Karen, any thoughts with that?
Well, I think it's clear because Unalaq had her open the spirit portal earlier that, you know, he's in on this whole harmonic convergence thing, probably trying to get the bad spirit out or whatever. So, I mean, it does feel a little convenient, and it does feel like, oh, all of a sudden we're learning about the harmonic convergence, whereas before there was really no direction to that. It was literally in these two episodes that we learned that this thing existed. So, yeah, it feels convenient, but I also feel like on Avatar and on Korra, those convenient things, I kind of write them off as like fate or destiny, because we're dealing with spirits so often that I feel like she was meant to get swallowed by that spirit, and she was meant to wash up on this island. She was meant to go through all of this in order to stop this. I mean, she, as the Avatar, is a very spiritual person. And so, you know, the stars kind of align, and all of a sudden she's in the right place at the right time, because that's just kind of like how this world works.
Caitlin, just going off what your favorite scene is going to be, which we'll get to in a second, do you feel like that the other Avatars know this story of Rava, like that during their life as the Avatar, like Aang obviously didn't know when we knew him as a child, but do you think during their lifespan that this is something like that they, when they go into the Avatar state, that they know about and maybe don't talk about or something like that?
Honestly, I've been wondering the same thing, and I wonder if that's something that was maybe lost along the way, like, and could have even been lost with Aang. Like, maybe even Roku knew, but the Hundred Years War kind of wiped it all away. In those 100 years, Aang was in the iceberg, wiped it all away. So I don't know how much they know. I would think maybe they don't know in their lifetime, because it's been 10,000 years and we lose a lot in 10,000 years. But when the spirits, when the current avatar dies and goes, becomes the spirit that the next avatar can tap into, then maybe they do have that understanding of who, where they come from.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. It's very, you know, I would have liked to get to see this story, basically. But yeah, it's interesting to think about. Brittany, do you have any kind of lingering questions or theories before we move on to our favorite scenes? What do you think is going to end up happening with this information now?
Well, I'm glad Korra is aware that she's the Avatar, and she now has someone else telling her what her purpose is.
So maybe she's not just trying to make it up as she goes along.
Yeah, maybe I'll start to like her a little bit more. I'm glad that she has a purpose. Like, I'm glad, like, there's, like, a, okay, this is actually, like, she's finally able to, like, see through the haze of, like, okay, my uncle's clearly doing something wrong now, and I know what it is, so I know kind of, like, whose side I should be on. So I'm just hoping that all of this makes me like Korra a little bit more going forward, and I think it will, as long as she remembers she's the Avatar. So.
Yeah.
Cool. Do it.
Fair enough. Okay, so favorite quotes and scenes from these two episodes. We've sort of pulled one from each. So our favorite scenes from part one and favorite quotes from part one. My favorite scene was the white dragon helping Wan perfect his firebending, and just the way that I think the people from his town were kind of discussing it and said that he was using, you know, the fire like it was an extension of his body, and the difference between just having the power to wield the element and what they actually call bending and the use of it rather than just sort of blasting, if you know what I mean. I really liked that, the development of firebending. So we'll just go down the list here in order.
Okay, my favorite scene is when Wan is accepted by the spirits, because I just thought it was sort of really beautiful that the spirits, who clearly did not like humans and had good reason not to like the humans, saw something different in him, especially because of how much he cared about animals, and it was just really nice for them to change their minds about him.
Yeah, and funny. Brittany?
So my favorite scene was Korra at the beginning not knowing who she was, because I feel like that's how she is 24/7 up until this point. She's like, I'm a flip a desk. Oh, that's right, I'm the Avatar. I'm going to punch these criminals out. Oh, that's right, I'm the Avatar. So this is like just perfect Korra, completely like stripped away of everything, and this is what's left. I have no idea who I am or what I'm doing. Sorry, I'll start to like Korra soon, I hope. I'm so sorry to everyone who loves Korra. The character. True. I like the series. The character needs some work.
Yeah. Poor Korra.
No, I feel bad, but...
It's okay, it'll end up okay. I will say that there's something... Well, there's many things that happen. There's something... I can't even say this without, like... I don't know how to say this. There's going to be a big chance for her to develop,
and she'll blow it.
Probably, and you will probably like her on the other side of that.
Okay.
Anyway, Caitlin.
Okay, so my favorite scene was when Korra goes into the waters and she starts seeing the avatars before her. So she sees Aang and Roku and Kyoshi and Kuruk. So I just like all those references back to her previous lives and the avatars we saw in Aala. So I like it.
Good times. My favorite quote was probably from the II spirit when he says, when he's talking about possessing the human and warping his face, and he says, if I stayed in there any longer, I would have killed him, which I did consider, because number one, it was funny, but number two, I just like that their idea of, like, kind of, I guess, good and evil and ruthlessness and stuff. I like that it's, as spirits, obviously very different to humans, and I don't know, I just liked it, like, a lot.
My favorite line was from Zaboomafoo, and it's when he's like, I'm going to call you Stinky, and Juan is like, my name is definitely Juan, and then Zaboomafoo goes, Stinky is more accurate.
You really like that guy.
I do.
Plus, Zaboomafoo is just really fun to say.
Yes.
So my favorite line was when Juan goes, there's more than one lion turtle? Because that was the question I've had since I took a quiz in the first, like, when we were watching Avatar, and it was like, which lion turtle are you? And I'm like, there's more than one lion turtle? And finally, it was answered now. So it's been, like, months and months and months of waiting for these lion turtle things to be answered, and there it was.
We didn't get to see too much of the different lion turtles. We saw the sort of the earthbending one, like, coming up from the ground, and that it's, like, land looks really terracotta-y. Another thing is it's clearly gone through an ice age in 10,000 years, because the spirit portal at the top and the bottom, they weren't in, like, an icy South Pole. You know how the waterbenders now are kind of, we associate them with, like, Eskimo culture, and it's, like, frozen lands both in the north and the south water tribe. They weren't frozen in the in this part at all. Like, they weren't frozen at this point in this world. So that, I don't know what happened to the geology of the land since then, but something. And anyway, carry on. Sorry.
So my favorite line was when Juan is trying to sneak into the oasis and he puts all the leaves on. He goes, I am Bushy, the bush spirit, and I would like to enter your oasis.
This was very soccer. Yeah.
The best part was, like, he believed him. Like, he was like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
he was like, oh,
okay. Yeah, it was great. It was so ridiculous. Some of the voice acting in this reminded me so much of soccer that I had to look up and check that it wasn't actually Jack DeSena doing the voice. It wasn't of Juan. It was not, but it really reminded me of it a few times. In the second half of the second part of the episode, my favorite scene was when the lemur spirit bows to him when returning to the spirit world, when he does, like, the respect bow. I really teared up. So that was my favorite part of that episode.
My favorite scene kind of goes right into Brittany's, actually. But mine was right before hers, when Juan sort of impresses everybody by using all four elements at once. And I liked that the humans were like, whoa, he's doing all four at one time. And that was just kind of cool.
Yeah, and then mine was, like, seeing the origin of the Avatar state. So once, like, what's the Raku? Raka? Rava? I can't remember. I wrote good spirit in quotations. When Rava enters Juan's body and, like, his eyes glow, I was like, oh, look at that. That's the Avatar state. Mm-hmm.
And mine was when Juan goes all Super Saiyan with all his elements and locks Vatu in his prison, because the animation in that is gorgeous. And it just looks really cool with the way that he locks him up with all the elements surrounding him before he puts him in the tree.
Yeah. Going into quotes, I liked basically when I think Juan was like, you know, we didn't even know there were other humans or other online turtles. And I think the spirit says, most humans think only of themselves, no matter how many others are around, which is, you know, universally true. So I just liked that. And hopefully some children learned some lessons or something from watching this. Yeah.
My line comes from my fave, Zaboomafoo, when he goes, Stinky, you came back.
Oh, it's very cute. Do you think he missed him?
Yeah, of course.
My favorite line was from Vatu when he was like, see you at the end of the world. And I was like, that's a little dramatic. But okay. I was like, all right.
bit.
And mine was when Juan comes to fight Vatu at Harmonic Convergence, and Vatu kind of laughs at him, and he's like, "No human can stand against me," to which Juan replies, "Haven't you heard the legends? I'm not a regular human anymore." Ooh. Bam!
Yeah. All right, well, that is it for our recap, unless anyone has any lingering questions about something to do with the episode that they didn't quite catch, or any discussion points that the group wanted to bring up. If not, our contact information, once again, if you want to reach us to give us feedback on our wonderful performance, or whatever we call our wonderful podcast that we've just created for you, you can reach us on rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com, Twitter re_watchable, this post on our home site Hyperball, where this podcast should be posted, or you can join us on rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. You can also give us a review on iTunes, which helps us feel really legit on the iTunes page. For every 5-star review on iTunes, Karen will feed the street rat a loaf of bread. So that's great. Are you ready to get your hands cut off?
What?
You know, with the stealing of the bread, your hands, they might get cut off.
I don't have to steal the bread. I just have to give a loaf of bread to a street rat.
And sing some Aladdin while you're at it.
That's fine. I would like to keep my hands.
Okay, fine. I guess you can keep your hands. We've got some feedback to give to you this week. And we've got a fairly long email here, and a few short comments and tweets. So I'll read this first one, and then you guys can read the short ones. So this is an email from Rick saying, "I'm a huge Avatar The Last Airbender and Legend of Korra fan, and I recently stumbled across your podcast. It's been very entertaining to hear all of your perspectives about Legend of Korra. I'll have to go back and hear what you said about Atla. I've always been under the impression that Season 2 started off so awkward because they were trying to continue a story of what was originally supposed to be a series finale. If they had known in advance that they would have 4 seasons, I don't think the creators would have given Korra her bending back, and I think that would have played a major part of her character growth in Season 2 to help mature her character naturally. Since that didn't happen, though, I assume that's what led to the awkward character regressions for the first half of the season, and I can assure the newbies her character will be noticeably improved coming out of this next 2-parter and will carry through for the rest of the series. I was just curious if you guys thought that the situation with how the series as a whole was handled had a significant role on the first comings of the first half of this season or not. Anyway, just keep doing what you're doing and I'll keep listening. Thanks for taking the time to go through the series and share your thoughts. There's a lot of great things coming up and I'm super excited to hear your thoughts. Thanks again, Rick." So this is an interesting point, I suppose, that I don't know too much of the specifics of that. They may have thought when they were writing season one that they were only doing one season. Caitlin, do you know much about that? I feel like that is accurate. I can't remember the specifics.
Thought they were doing a 12-episode miniseries that would have been self-contained. That's why it wrapped up so quickly and nicely in the very last half of the last episode. So
yeah,
that's absolutely on point.
Yeah. So do you guys think that you would have liked it better if they'd known? Oh, obviously, you know, any time that you know that you're writing in advance is more of a chance to develop a story. But would have you liked what Rick suggested with her not getting her bending back and working towards that? Brittany, how would you have felt about Korra, you know, given your hatred of her in the first half of season two?
Well,
how would you have felt about Rick's theory?
Well, that was the exact theory that Adiana and I had when we thought the finale was, like, we thought that she wasn't going to get her bending back because we didn't know, like, you know, obviously the series, like, you know, whether or not they're coming back and et cetera after that. So I personally thought that the next 3 seasons were going to be her getting her bending back and having to relearn everything. And I was so excited for that.
Like one per season or something.
Yeah. And like, I was I was pumped. I was like, yes, she's going to have to learn everything. Like, we're going to like get some like Zuko for a whole season when she has to remaster firebending. This is going to be great. And then no. So that didn't happen.
Sorry.
But yeah, that's okay.
Sorry. Never mind. And then there was something else that he said that I was gonna say that was an interesting point. Oh yes. Rick saying he stumbled across the podcast. I'm curious, listeners, if you want to write in and tell us how you discovered Rewatchable, if it's through Hyperball or if it's like through your fandom, like if, you know, we're covering a show that's in your fandom and that you didn't know about us before that or something like that. So I'm curious about how people stumble across the podcast when we do various different shows. So if you ever want to write in and tell us your Rewatchable origin story, that would be fun, I think. So, yeah. Okay. We'll go down with Karen, Brittany, and Caitlin with these last few comments here. So do you want to go ahead, Karen?
Sure. This first one comes from Hypeball, and it's from Carl, who says, "Something that makes the show more believable is the love affairs. Mako and Asami kissing again was just obvious. I mean, look in real life. Who doesn't have complicated love affairs? How many of us ever had sex with an ex? Winky face." Yes.
Right, Carl, this is a show for children.
Oh, please. We've dropped, like, the F-bomb so many times on this show. But, yeah, I mean, I get it. And I do think that it's realistic, but it's frustrating going back and forth and not having the characters learn something that is real life. But, you know, real life isn't always the greatest thing to look at when you're trying to tell a story about the growth of a character, because so many people, you know, don't ever learn. Like, and those people are so frustrating to be friends with because you just want to shake them. So while it is realistic, you know, it is disappointing. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But yeah, I don't know. Hopefully they will learn more over the next couple of seasons.
So our next comment on Hypeable, and I think these last two comments could not have been given to better people, but our next comment is from, I think it's Sukai, and they say, "Guys, my favorite line and scene in episode 5 was when one of the townspeople told Cora to get a real job at the rally. I laughed way too hard for way too long. If you missed it, go back and watch, listen carefully. It was just before the bomb went off."
Yeah.
So that's pretty great and accurate to my feelings right now.
I was not on that episode last week, but I did watch it last night when I was catching up to watch these episodes. And oh my God, she's so stupid. Like, why was she at that rally? Like it's, I understand that she's from there, but like, and I understand that it was obvious that the North were being bad, but they were, everyone else was right. Like her showing, like her leading, like the side of one side of a protest was super dumb. But anyway, sorry, carry on, Caitlin, with the next one.
And we have a tweet from Peggy Ruiz, who's at Ginny081 on Twitter. She says, "The animation for chapter 7 and 8 of book 2 is amazing. By the way, the Oasis is totally Spirited Away," which totally is. There's even a no-face spirit, which we see in Spirited Away. And if you guys haven't seen Spirited Away, it's amazing and you should totally watch it.
I want to just say one last thing about the Spirit Oasis, which I was trying to work out. Given that there's no snow at the North and South Poles in this time of Avatar, is this the same Spirit Oasis where Yue got dunked in the sea, or is this just a random oasis?
I mean, it could be. It was designed kind of similar, now that I think about it. Although Zuko didn't pop out of a wall and give me chills like he did last time, but...
Sorry.
I'm still holding out. He's got to come back.
Needs more Zuko.
I mean, you know we know he's alive, given the last couple of episodes.
But I haven't seen his painted face, so...
Sorry. Can't you just go with General Iroh, who has better chemistry with Korra than Mako ever will, FYI. And I'm like, they General Iroh and Korra could have had it all. I'm just saying, they really could have, but never mind. That might be just be me. Write in if you've ever shipped Korra and General Iroh, because I really did at this point in the series. All right, we'll go now, unless anyone else has anything to say. Nope, all good. We're all good. All right, so we will see you guys next week with whatever members of our motley crew end up making it to next week's couple of episodes, when Korra gets to go back to the real world and remember who she is. And we get to find out, you know, how evil everyone really is. So until then, I am Natalie.
I'm Karen.
I'm Brittany.
And I'm Caitlin.
And we have been rewatchable Legend of Korra. So bye-bye.
Bye.